Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Continuing with our ongoing exploration of alternative healing systems, I'll be sharing insights from different sources all over the world who are discovering that there are ways that we can overcome many of the conditions we have and prevent other conditions from occurring. I believe that it's as important to share what doesn't work so that we don't become victimized as it is what does work that we can reverse or prevent a condition. In either case, much of this information is generally not disseminated in the mainstream media. Later on in the program, I'll also be taking calls. Because I'm not in New York, I'm thousands of miles away. I'm not able to access all the other stations around the country. So for this week, next week, and the week after, when I do take calls, it'll just be for people in the tri-state area. I will be doing live broadcasts next week with KPFK, Roy of Hollywood, and for 6 hours. And I'll be doing PFW next week as well and the week after. So you'll have a chance to call in on those programs. For the New York tri-state area, you can call 212-279-2900. That's 212-279-2900. I'm sorry, 209. Okay, sorry, it's 209-2900. Please correct that. That's 212-209-2900. We'll go to those calls in about 10, 15 minutes. This comes from Aline and O'Reilly, and thank you for sending this. It says, this is something that she wrote called Anyway. People are unreasonable, illogical, and self-centered. Love them anyway. If you do good, people will accuse you of being selfish and having ulterior motives. Do good anyway. If you're successful, you win false friends and true enemies. Succeed anyway. The good you do will be forgotten tomorrow. Do good anyway. Honesty and frankness make you vulnerable. Be honest and frank anyway. What you spent years building may be destroyed overnight. Build anyway. People really need help but may attack you if you help them. Help them anyway. Give the world the best you have and you'll get kicked in the teeth. Give the world the best you've got anyway. And this is from a sign on a wall of Shishi Bhavan, a children's home in Calcutta. So, thank you, Aline, for sending that. Some time ago, recently in fact, there was a special that got an enormous amount of media attention on ABC. And it was a program entitled Tampering with Nature, hosted by John Stossel. After that show aired, I received thousands of complaints of people who said, isn't there something that can be done? Can we challenge it? Well, of course, doing something after the fact, you do have the benefit of being able to review it carefully, objectively, fairly, and see if indeed there was bias and selective reporting of facts, and then we can then make a presentation. In at least the small form we have, it is dwarfed by the amount of people who actually saw it and were probably moved or motivated by it. You don't always know, and you cannot always prove what a person's real ulterior motives were. However, you can certainly challenge those points that you feel are open to question or a reasonable doubt as to their objectivity. Because I am working currently on an international campaign to challenge the entire AIDS community, and I'm traveling from country to country meeting with people to offer to debate any of their ministers of health and provide hard scientific data that virtually everything they're doing on AIDS is wrong and actually killing their people, not helping them. And the drugs that the either expensive or cheap drugs, either one, is not the answer to their health crisis, certainly not the AIDS crisis or what we're calling the AIDS crisis. So that's had an enormous amount of my time and attention, and it's coinciding with the completion of my long-worked-on AIDS documentary, Deconstructing the Myth of AIDS, which has been almost now, when it's totally complete, will be 3 years in the making. It's the longest time I've ever spent actually on a documentary. But we're in the last 2 weeks of 3 weeks at the outside. When it's done, I will announce a single public showing that'll be at a theater in New York City, and anyone who wishes to come will. I will be sending a copy of that to every minister of health of every country in the world, every member of Congress, and every member of every state health oversight committee in the United States. Plus, there is a CD that is 35 hours long that I'm sending with it, a CD-ROM, so they can have additional backup documentation. So there's a lot of information. That's really what I'm trying to do at the moment. Other projects are pretty much on the side, so I really didn't have a chance to review this as I did the first one on organic gardening that he did, where I found there was a great many mistakes and inaccuracies, and we challenged them on that. In fact, that actually caused the network to insist that he go on and apologize, which he did. I'm hopeful we can do the same here. But just today I read on my email that Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, their media analysis, and they critique the news reports, they had a report that I reviewed it, and I don't believe I could do better at this time, so I'm going to report it, and then you can use it as a way of challenging the network to at least reapproach these subjects. Now, because I've written extensively on the environment, and I had one of the more popular books on environmental challenges called Clear, Cleaner, Safer, Greener, A Blueprint for a New Environment. And in fact, I'm actually updating that. I was able to review the so-called facts of John Stossel, and virtually every single point he made, I felt, was inaccurate. I cannot ascribe motive. I can only look at, did he say something that can be challenged? And the answer is yes. My report will be later on, maybe in 2 or 3 months, because for the next 2 or 3 months, I've got an enormous amount of work to do and on helping with this AIDS issue. So here is the Fairness and Accuracy Reporting. I'll quote it. July 17th. Stossel tampers with the facts. John Stossel plays by a different set of rules than other journalists, as demonstrated most recently by Tampering with Nature, a one-hour special that aired on ABC on June 29th. Taking advantage of the unusual leeway the network gives him, ABC's favorite free market zealot used the special to attack environmentalists, who are caricatured as preachers of doom and gloom, whose extreme anti-technology views would have us all running around naked, hungry for food, maybe killing a rabbit with a rock, then dying young, probably before the age of 40, unquote, is what Stossel said. And as is often the case, Stossel's reporting relied on biased sources, twisted facts, and the exclusion of information that might conflict with his thesis. Central to Stossel's argument is that schools are overrun with green propaganda, leaving him to wonder, is this education or environmental boot camp? To Stossel and his carefully chosen guests, kids are being brainwashed when in fact there's little reason to worry about the environment. Deforestation, for example, is a non-issue, according to one of Stossel's main sources, Patrick Moore, a former director of Greenpeace who now works for the timber industry. Moore explains that the forest cover in the United States today is about the same as it was in 1920. Stossel chimes in, I don't read that in the Greenpeace fundraiser, suggesting that groups like Greenpeace are part of a huge industry that profits by manufacturing a crisis. It's true that the total U.S. forest cover has been roughly stable over the last century, but taking total acreage as the sole indicator of environmental well-being is a simplistic approach. It discounts, for example, that the U.S. has logged most of its old growth forest, which are crucial to biodiversity. Deforestation is a global crisis with global impact. Most of the forest work done by Greenpeace, for instance, focuses not on the relatively well-protected U.S., but on Brazil, Canada, and other areas where forest loss threatens the climate, endangered species, and indigenous people. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization finds that deforestation is running about 22 million acres per year, an estimate many environmentalists say is too low, since it counts new tree plantations the same as older forest. And are you worried about pollution? Well, then you're no better than those brainwashed school children. He says, quote, "Why don't they know the facts? The EPA says that over the past 30 years, the air has been getting cleaner. Every major pollutant the government measures is decreasing." Stossel's implication that the EPA data shows environmental improvement across the board is clearly incorrect. In fact, the EPA's website states that, quote, "total U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, which include carbon dioxide, nitrous oxides, methane, hydrofluorocarbons, perfluorocarbons, and sulfur hexafluoride, has risen significantly over the last several years to 11.2% above 1990 baseline. And as of 1998, and that emissions per person in the U.S. have increased by 3.4% in the last 7 years. These emissions certainly qualify as major pollutants in terms of their environmental impact. Stossel's discussion of global warming was highly selective in the information it presented. Instead of reporting the increasingly strong scientific consensus on global warming, Stossel chose to highlight the views of the so-called skeptics, giving center stage to three dissenters from among the 2,000 scientists of the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which recently released a report stating that global temperatures are rising about twice as fast as previously thought. To back up the skeptics' claim, Stossel presents some deceptive evidence. Quote, "You may have heard that 1,600 scientists signed a letter warning of devastating consequences, but I bet you haven't heard of 17,000 scientists signed a petition saying there's no convincing evidence that the greenhouse gases will disrupt the Earth's climate." The implication is that 10 times as many scientists question global warming. What Stossel doesn't note is that while the first petition was circulated by a group of well-respected scientists, the second petition has been famously discredited. The first smaller petition came from the Union of Concerned Scientists, and its signatories included 110 Nobel laureates, including 104 of the 178 living Nobel Prize winners in sciences, along with 60 U.S. National Medal of Science winners. The latter petition was a project of the George C. Marshall Institute, whose chair, Frederick Seitz, is also affiliated with the Global Climate Coalition. That's a pro-industry group calling itself the Voice for Business in the Global Warming Debate, in conjunction with the Oregon Institute of Medical Science Medicine, a lesser-known group whose leader also is pro-industry. Now, though these signatories did include some reputable scientists, it also included dentists, nutritionists, and others with no expertise in climatology. The only requirement for signing on was a baccalaureate in science. In fact, their screening process was so lax that for a time the list also included a number of gag names added by environmentalists, including Ginger Spice and Michael J. Fox. The petition also came under fire for being deceptively packaged. The petition was accompanied by an article purporting to debunk global warming that was formatted to look as though it had been published in the journal of the respected National Academy of Sciences. The resemblance was so close that the National Academy of Sciences issued a public statement that the petition, quote, "does not reflect the conclusions of experts' reports of the Academy," unquote. None of this controversy was mentioned in the Stossel report. Stossel also cites an Energy Department study that says, if we try to reduce global warming by restricting emissions, gas prices will go up 50%, electricity 80%. Stossel doesn't say exactly what study he's citing, but the numbers are most likely from the Energy Information Administration, which supplies data for the Energy Department. In October of 1998, the Energy Information Agency predicted that if the Kyoto Protocol were implemented, electricity prices might rise anywhere from 20 to 86% by year 2010, while gasoline prices might rise 11% to 53%. But the report also predicted the prices could decline as energy markets adjust and more efficient, new technologies become available and gradually penetrate the market. The report also cautioned the amount prices must rise is uncertain. Forecasting technological change and public response to it under various pricing scenarios is an inexact science. It becomes even more inexact when Stossel picks the numbers he likes best out of a broad range. But there's no science to it. During the program, absurd contentions by the guest Stossel favors pass without comment. Example, the average person hears that temperature has changed a half a degree. According to Richard Lindzen of MIT, so what? Changes more than that while they wait for the streetlight to change. Well, it's obvious that local temperatures have a wide range, that even small changes in the average global temperature can have profound effects. Stossel lets this sophistry pass, but activists he doesn't agree with are not treated so kindly. You're a scaremonger, he scolded genetic engineer critic Jeremy Rifkin. Why should we listen to you? Perhaps the most controversial aspect of the piece was Stossel's use of children. ABC had filmed interviews with school children from Santa Monica, California. The children's parents originally signed consent forms, but later withdrew them, citing concern over Stossel's leading questions. The fact that Stossel's participation had not been mentioned until the last minute. Stossel's strategy was to get the students to make inaccurate statements about the environment, then blame the environmentalist propaganda that is taught in the schools. The tactic is demeaning and absurd. One could imagine Stossel quizzing students on spelling or math and explaining incorrect answers as the result of propaganda campaign. Stossel doesn't mention the fact that actual propaganda paid for by industries bent on improving their environmental image is increasingly used in place of materials designed by educators in Americans' classrooms. In the end, Stossel took a fair amount of criticism for his manipulative tactics, and ABC forced him to pull the original interviews from the broadcast. One can't say he learned from the incident, though. He merely interviewed a different set of children to achieve the same results. It's hard to imagine another journalist getting away with what Stossel does. It's ironic that a report on the evils of propaganda relied so heavily on misinformation and selective omissions, tried and true propaganda techniques, to prove his points. Let ABC News know that Stossel's manipulative interviews with children for the Tampering with Nature special were not the only things that should be of concern. Ask them to provide airtime to advocates for the points of view Stossel attacks in his reporting. ABC News phone number is 212-456-7777. And as always, please remember that your comments are taken more seriously if you maintain a polite tone. So that's that. I want to thank Fairness and Accuracy Media for doing that report. I'm Gary Nall. For those of you just joining us, we're talking about some of the issues that need to be aired. And here's one that comes from the Associated Press, Tammy Weber. This is one of those reports that the more you know about what doesn't work, the better it is for you not to become a victim of it. A heart monitoring procedure used by more than a million times a year during major operations appears to serve, quote, no benefit and may actually raise the risk of heart attacks, a study found. Right heart catheterization, in which a thin, flexible tube is inserted into a neck vein and guided into the right side of the heart, is used during major non-cardiac operations such as a hip replacement and gallbladder removal on patients who have a history of heart trouble. It has been used on patients for 30 years to monitor the heart for everything from fluid pressure to oxygen content. However, researchers at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston found no benefit to the procedure and said the risk of heart attacks and other cardiac problems was 300% greater among patients who had had it than those who did not. The procedure should be reevaluated, the researcher said. Their study, which appeared in Wednesday's Journal of the American Medical Association, supports earlier findings. Now, my thought on this. I'm adding this to the enormous amount of data on iatrogenic episodes. Iatrogenic means injury due to medical procedures, including drugs. It is the shadow of medicine that never seems to have a face or a specific image for us to pay attention to. It's as if in our enthusiasm, our desire to believe that whatever is the best is what we're going to get, that we don't stop long enough to challenge many of the procedures that we're given, and from everything from routine exams like an annual pap smear to a chest x-ray to, in 1950 and 51, in New York State, for instance, every month kids had to get a fluoroscopic examination. That was equivalent to giving about 100 chest x-rays per month per kid for 2 years. Then we wonder why those kids today, as adults, have cancer. Well, we shouldn't have to wonder too much, because a one single x-ray in your life is enough to cause cancer. One single x-ray. Now, think of how many dentists have given routine x-rays, chiropractors routine x-rays, your general practitioner, oh, just to be on the safe side, your annual chest x-ray. Why? In part because it's defensive medicine. There was a time when doctors did not do these excessive procedures or unnecessary procedures. But then after people began to sue and we became a highly litigious society where anybody can sue anyone for anything, doctors became targets. So they made sure to minimize their chance of having anyone win a lawsuit that they would do every possible procedure, whether you needed it or not, more often not. And this way they could never be blamed for not having done something to find something. But at what cost? At the cost of now, we are suffering a myriad of conditions because of excessive testing, unnecessary drugs, and unnecessary procedures and dangerous procedures, unproven procedures and disproven procedures. But you would never know this if you listened to your average physician or attended an average medical class. The problem is that we continue to focus on the hope and promise of more is better, more funding for more research, whether it's AIDS or cancer or heart disease. We're sure we'll conquer it if we just wrote more checks. And so we're spending $1.8 trillion this year, it'll be $2 trillion next year, on disease. Virtually nothing on prevention, and not a single national policy on dietary, exercise, behavior modification, and environmental awareness of how all these together impact upon the cause of disease or the progress of the disease once it is manifesting. So now there are 5,000 studies plus that show that many of the very common procedures that we receive, very common medications we receive, A, are too toxic or do not work or do not work for the condition being given, or are not part of a healing process. And yet, because of our lack of honesty in acknowledging when something doesn't work and giving it up, surrendering it so we can go forward, we continue to use these procedures. I'm suggesting at some point we should have a national referendum on reforming medicine from top to bottom, from the curriculum in medical schools to start allowing courses to be taught physicians on energy medicine, on even something as simple as bedside manners, because they're atrocious today. And to the doctors also, to stop some of the ways that doctors are treated. Many doctors don't even want to go into certain specialties because they have such high malpractice premiums. It doesn't make it worth it. And yet, many of those we need. Also, the almost exclusive use of drugs on conditions or even creating conditions for which a drug then can be used. All this has to be reformed. It cannot be done piecemeal. We haven't been honest about how bad medicine is and how much of it doesn't work. That's why if you go to the website, GaryNull.com, look under iatrogenic episodes, the entire history of the medicine that doesn't work, specific drugs, procedures, surgical, whatever it is, and the citations in the scientific literature to show you these are all from peer-reviewed journals, you will get a shock. It's a real eye-opener. And we've had, I guess, about 100,000 hits on the site. But there are 700,000 doctors, and I'd like just to get them to be aware of what they're doing, that maybe in all honesty they believe that they're trying to do good but using the wrong procedures. And if you don't educate the doctor, it's unlikely the doctor's going to know about this, in which case they can be offering what they think will work, which actually hurts you. I go through all of the, for instance, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Yeah, they're able to stop it for a while, but then look at the statistics of how many of the children who had the therapy, the chemotherapy, multiple chemotherapy, end up with rare cancers that kill them quickly when they're 18, 19, and 20. Then that, to me, is not a successful protocol. And look at the people who will have a tumor removed, like a breast tumor removed from surgery, but then follow with aggressive chemotherapy and radiation, or radiation and chemotherapy, when every single study that I have reviewed shows that those are not therapeutic, do not extend the quality of life, and actually cause a high degree of secondary cancers, which then do kill the people. Yet the oncologist is not reading the literature. So we have to do that for them. After all, remember, any doctor that you see, you have a relationship with. You're paying them, or through their insurance, which is still something you're paying, through either your taxes if it's federal, or through your premiums if it's private. So you have a right to communicate with them. Don't be intimidated. Take your facts, sit with them, and ask them to show you the proof that whatever medicine they're giving you is safe and effective. If you have arthritis and they're giving you non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, let them know that each year they're killing more people with non-steroidal anti-inflammatories for just arthritis. That's just one condition with one type of drug than the first 3 years of all American casualties in Vietnam. And you don't hear a thing about it. But the citation from the New England Journal of Medicine of last June is on the webpage. You can read it. And that's a very understated figure. It's the probability is it's closer to about 10 times that. Probably closer to about 150,000 or more people dying from just 1 year, from just arthritis treatment, from just non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. So if you don't know this information, think at what risk you place yourself when you go to get something and you take it for granted that what you're getting has got to work or you wouldn't get it, or was safe or you wouldn't get it. Trust neither of those two assumptions, and you'll be doing yourself a big favor. This comes from AP, sent to me by Johnny Asia. Thank you, Johnny, for sending this. Hartford, Connecticut. When Sheila Matthews' son was in first grade, a school psychologist diagnosed him with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and gave his parents information on Ritalin. Matthews refused to put him on the drug. She believed the boy was energetic and outgoing but not disruptive, and she suspected the school system was trying to medicate him just to make it easier for the teachers. Now the state of Connecticut has weighed in on the side of the parents, like the Matthews, with a first-in-the-nation law that reflects a growing backlash against what some see as overuse of Ritalin and other behavioral drugs. The law, approved unanimously by the legislature and signed by Governor John R. Rowland, prohibits teachers, counselors, and other school officials from recommending psychiatric drugs for any child. The measure does not prevent school officials from recommending that a child be evaluated by a medical doctor, but the law is intended to make sure the first mention of drugs for a behavior or learning problem comes from a doctor. I congratulate Sheila Matthews and her family. It shows that one person can make a difference. She refused, she fought, she legislated, she won. And now we should start looking in New York and every other place in the United States. Ban the pseudo mental health people, including teachers who are frustrated and want their classes to be uniform. And not all teachers by any means are this mindset, but enough are. And they're the first ones who are causing children to be stigmatized. And then in come these school mental health counselors. This is a gift from Bill Clinton, one of his many gifts that is like giving someone herpes and saying, I hope you enjoy it. Well, we don't enjoy having mental health counselors in every school who have the right to dictate if your child is mentally impaired in some way or has the potential to create harm. These are untrained individuals, and it's like, well, quite simply, it's a totalitarian school system. I'm opposed to this. I'm totally opposed. So school teachers have no right, no business, no education, no background, nothing, zero, to tell any parent your child has ADD and ADHD, which don't exist to begin with. It's total fraud. If you want more background on that, I put it up on my webpage under Abuses in Psychiatry. And read the series. It's there for you. Take advantage of it. We've got to stop abusing our children in the name of saving them. The Janet Reno syndrome. And it's time that, in particular, if you're told your child has ADD and ADHD, don't believe it. I have had so many parents come to me with their children who are on Prozac and Ritalin. Or Paxil and Ritalin. I speak with the child. I ask them which classes they like, which classes they don't like, which teachers they enjoy listening to and learning from, which teachers they might be fearful of or intimidated by or angry with. And then I ask the parent who's sitting here, I say, well, I got a question for you. You've accepted this diagnosis of ADHD. You've accepted the child should take Ritalin. Did they explain to you that ADHD, that is it so unique that your child could be suffering from ADHD in one class and completely normal in the next class? And the parent, like a fainting goat that gets stressed, kind of faints on the floor and rolls around in a circle. They've been asked a legitimate question and their brain just can't comprehend it. Gee, I never thought of asking a question that actually had reason and logic to it, Gary. I just assume anything anyone ever told me in life was true, especially if it's a school teacher. Yeah, well, that's why we have so many bright kids today who love to go to school. No, we have an awful lot of bright kids today. And we shouldn't punish the bright kids in America because the teachers are in some way not capable of understanding what do you do with a child that has a lot of energy naturally. It's not a disease. What do you do with a child that is very creative, that sees the world from a different perspective? You don't punish someone who has a gift. Or a person has gone through issues or has gone through issues at home, that's an emotional issue. It's not a brain biochemical issue. You can subdue a person's personality chemically, in effect giving them a chemical lobotomy. You can have everyone in a class just look and stare at you. If that's what you want, well, that's what we're getting to. But then when I take the kid through a process of simply asking what they like and don't like, and gee whiz, it's about what is normal. The things that we're attracted to and things we're not. Just before I left on this trip, I was counseling a family, and both a husband and wife are both lawyers. In fact, she's a very prominent one, and I didn't know that before I started talking because I asked them, you know, what their background was, and I'm thinking, now here are two people who are clearly capable of doing their homework and have access to the research. So first thing I asked them was, can you bring with me, before I see you, the studies that confirm that ADHD is what you have been told by your school psychologist and by your psychiatrist and the school teacher and the mental health counselor that is an organic brain disease. Please bring me the studies. 3 weeks later, they show up. Did you do your homework? Yes. Did you find any studies? No. Mm-hmm. Did you look? Yes, we looked. Did you look everywhere? Yes. So you cannot find a single study. Okay, well, that's correct. There is no such study. Doesn't exist. Does not exist. So what does that tell you right off? Well, we don't know. I mean, you know, we're not the psychologists. Well, thank God. And that you're not a psychologist, because it doesn't make you brighter or more aware of human nature. It just means that you're better able to play the hooju mooju. It's a stupid game. It's a pathetic game. Show me the proof that schizophrenia is an organic brain disease. Show it to me. They tried to claim that it was genetic. That's how they were saving the kids, by diagnosing them. They thought that an aggressive child, any aggression at all, was a pattern of pre-schizophrenia in its early stages. So if you just happen to have a child that's very energetic, uh-oh, that's a child with a diagnosis waiting to happen and a treatment schedule behind it. All, of course, for the good of the child. I said, now I got a second question for you. Have you ever actually sat and asked your child what the child likes and does not like? No. Why? Why would a baby boomer parent ever do that? I mean, God forbid that we actually don't put our ego needs into the child's psyche. As if there's nothing legitimate or special or spiritual or original for the child themselves. Every single step they take in life must be in our previous step. So we tell them what they should expect and what they should do and give them the tools to do it. The trouble is, these are from us and our perspective. They don't honor the child at all. No one had ever asked him. They were expected to learn. You go to school to learn. We spend the best school. We spend all this money. Do you see how hard we work? We sacrifice so you can have things. Child didn't ask for this. Child just knows that there are certain classes they like, certain classes they don't like, certain classes they're bored with. You know, and it's not unusual to have teachers who do what is called a floating standard. The floating standard is you take the slowest child and the fastest child, and you go to the middle, and then you dip down to there to make sure that slowest child doesn't get held back. What do you think it does to everyone else? Well, for the athletes in the audience, let me put it this way. Let's say you've been training at a 4-minute mile and you start a race, but now everybody wants you to run at a 10-minute mile so that no one's left behind. Well, okay. There are ways of teaching to honor all the different levels of a child's ability to comprehend and use the information. But we are punishing creative children, energetic children, bright children. And that's an awful lot of children. And unfortunately, once you start giving the drugs, you also give them the capacity to have suicidal thoughts and homicidal tendencies, where they would never have thought about hurting other people or themselves. Now they walk into a school with a machine gun and start blowing people away, then kill themselves. Those very same parents can't wait then till legislation comes out so that we can enforce laws that will be stricter on children without ever looking at the real cause of this crime. So I talk with the child and ask him what the child eats. Well, it starts the day with sometimes a sugar-coated cereal and a cup of coffee or a cola. How many colas do you have a day? This is one boy. 7. Mm-hmm. What else? Grilled cheese sandwich or hamburger for dinner? We never eat together. Parents get home late. Everyone's too tired, so we kind of eat out. We 48 out. Fast food, yes. Okay. When was the last time you all actually sat down to a meal, relaxed, and enjoyed a healthy meal? Kid looks at me, laughs. Says, not my house. I look at the parents. Do you realize, and the pay, and how hard, and the hours, and this response, and, yeah, well, let's go down the, let me make an excuse for being a screw-up as a parent, and let me show you all the things I sacrificed to get to where I'm at. Okay, my child's health and well-being, yeah, but I provided. God save us from baby boomers who succeeded anything. We're in trouble. So they didn't like what I had to say because in the end it had nothing to do with the young fella. It had everything to do with them. This conversation went on for 5 hours. At the end, I asked him, he's 14 years old, I asked him, so what do you think? He said, he laughed and he said, Ron, old man, he said, you could tell them this stuff. I can't tell them this stuff. They ain't going to listen to me. I'm the problem child. I asked them to give up all the stuff they were eating, make time in their world to sit down as a family, go to the health food store, food co-op, and buy good quality, wholesome food, start the day with juices, hot cereal. Have time to do things together. Don't demand anything of the boy. Let him start to create his own reality and honor him for it. Be there as a support system. Exercise together. Go to a ball game together. Go fishing together. Do stuff together. And I got an email. Got an email from the boy, and he's very happy. They got him off the drug and have noticed a tremendous difference, a positive difference in themselves. They weren't overweight, but their energy level has skyrocketed, according to them. And they're very happy to be able to spend some time together and without always correcting him or looking at this, you know, why were we burdened with this? You know, what did we do wrong that allowed us to have this genetic defect? And now they realize they don't have a genetic defect. They have a gift, a rare and beautiful and special gift. And a very interested, dynamic, curious young person. And hopefully they will continue this process. I intend to see them when I get back in 2 weeks. And I doubt if either of them are listening. But if they are, life's about choices. And there's a point to where you got to actually look at what it is we're doing. On the one hand, you've got 5 or 10 million people who support that ADHD and ADD are real, and all the psychiatrists, psychologists, and behavioralists, and school teachers, not all, but the vast majority, support that this is a real situation. How long will it take before we show that it's not and we've all been lied to? It'll take a while. But think how many other things from the past we've been lied to about, and it took a while. So, but in this case, the children are the ones being hurt, stigmatized. So good for you, Sheila Matthews, and your son. And happy to see what you've done in Connecticut. This comes from the EPA advisory panel. Eric Panin, Washington Post staff writer. Toxic chemical review process faulted. I'll quote, scientist and expert who advised the Environmental Protection Agency on a broad range of regulations governing toxic chemicals in the air and water quality frequently have ties to the affected industries or other conflicts of interest, according to a new government study. The General Accounting Office reports found serious deficiencies in the EPA's procedures for preventing conflicts of interest and ensuring a proper balance of views amongst many members of the science advisory panels. For example, 4 of the 13 panel members who studied the cancer risks of the toxic chemical 1,3-butadiene had worked for chemical companies or industry-affiliated research organizations, including one who had worked for a company that manufactured it. The GAO found similar problems on 3 other cancer risk assessment panels in recent years. In 1, 7 of 17 advisory board members work for chemical companies or for industry-affiliated research organizations who had accepted fees from chemical companies. So what's this mean? What this means is that when the EPA or any of these agencies tell us that something is not toxic because a group of peer-reviewed high blue ribbon panel, well, you just now know that the industry has got its own people, the fox in the chicken coop, saying, of course this chemical doesn't cause cancer. How could it? I receive large amounts of money each year in research grants from that very company. So I say, no. Can we see hands? You others say no, and the others who don't say no, well, you know, too bad for you. You thought there was integrity in the process, honesty, decency. You thought that science was beyond reproach. Science is approach. Approach with the right number of zeros after the person's name in a checkbook, and watch how quickly that pedigree turns over to you and your interest. Nowhere can we go from the FDA, the EPA, the CDC, National Institutes of Health, the corporate interest have infiltrated every sphere and control the outcome to their advantage. I'm Gary Nall. Let's go to the phones. See who's on the line. Our number, 212-209-2900. Hi, what's your name, please?
Hello. This is Ken. I had a question. This deals with when you were talking about procedures, specifically colonoscopies, and one, whether or not they are useful, and number two, their safety in terms of, you know, the fact that it's used on other people, infectivity, and especially with things like mad cow, etc.
Well, ideally, they should not be using the same equipment. After all, if you factor in what it costs to get a colonoscopy, it clearly is a high margin of profit because it's basically a service. And nothing should be reused that enters the colon, because if there should be any of the prions, they cannot be destroyed by autoclave or normal sterilization techniques. Though there is, in about 4 months, I'm going to be reopening a laboratory to do a lot more research. There's an awful lot of ideas I have I want to go back in. I haven't been in doing research in the last 2 years, and I want to get back at it. And I'm going to try some experiments using particular forms of ozone in different solution to see what it will do, whether it will or will not affect the prions. I'm going to try it. Anyhow, I would never allow a piece of equipment that had been used in someone's rectum to be used on mine. As to the value, yes, if you're a vegetarian, if you have a lot of fiber in the diet, if you have no symptoms, I see no reason to get it at all. The only persons who would, I believe, need it are persons who would have symptoms that could not be understood or diagnosed in any other procedure, a history of diverticulitis, a spastic colon, colon cancer, or polyps, because there's sometimes you simply do not know what level of infection the diverticular pockets are at. And if any of those perforate into the abdominal cavity, you could die of acute septicemia. And therefore, that is a legitimate diagnostic procedure, but not as a routine procedure. And again, all these routine procedures, I do not see the value of them. There has to be something that indicates a reason for it. And I do not believe, I believe that with the price you're paying, you should just as easily get brand new instruments to be used. I also believe that's true in every surgery. When you realize the average cost of a surgery, let's say for most surgeries, is somewhere around $3,500, and that doesn't include the higher ones for coronary bypass, which would skew that way up, you could easily get the surgical procedures, instruments like scalpels as a part of that process. Operations are very profitable. They could afford a margin of that profit to go to towards new instruments instead of reusing the old ones and hence infecting people, as they recently did when 9 people were put at risk who were operated on after a person who had the human form of mad cow disease was operated on down at Tulane University Medical School.
Yeah, that's my concern. Does it even
We'll take another call. What's your name, please? You're on the air.
John.
John, hi, John.
Thank you for having me on the air and giving me the opportunity to talk.
Uh-huh.
I was calling because, actually, I have a 2-month-old daughter, and a couple of days from now, we have to decide as to doing vaccinations. And I've been going through reading some of the literature that you have provided at your website, and also talking to people that we know that have gone through the procedure. And I guess I just wanted to say that it's a very difficult choice to make because of the fact that the organizations and institutions make it almost impossible for you to educate or, you know, bring your kids to daycare and other things without vaccinations. And at the same time, there is seems to be a lot of risk in doing the procedures. So we are actually looking at some of the newer vaccines that have emerged, I think, in the past couple of years that apparently are less, let's say, risky than the older types of, like, the polio drops versus polio injection and the DPT vaccine that also, I think, was changed.
What's your question? You've made a comment. Do you have a question?
Yeah, my question is basically, is there maybe some more information or somewhere where I can go to find out about the vaccines and maybe more up-to-date information about the choice that we may have?
Well, as far as up-to-date information, I believe I'm as up-to-date as possible. We're up-to-date virtually every week. And then the main study, which was put up this year, every week I add studies to it. In fact, anything in the world literature that comes out is added to it. In the end, you have to look at what the Orthodox is saying and what an alternative is suggesting, and you have to ask both the question, and it is in the fairness of this question that you can make a more informed choice. If they're suggesting that the DPT vaccine is necessary, then ask them to show you the proof that it has both been effective in preventing these conditions and safe where there was no sudden infant death, autism, or gross immune modulation in the children receiving it, babies receiving it. And let them show you a study over a period of 5 years or even 3 years. Now, if it is safe and effective for those conditions, they'll be able to provide you with that data. And go through the National Institutes of Allergy and Infection, and go through the National Institutes of Health, and go through the CDC and ask them. Then go to the study specifically that I cite that show that the DPT vaccine has been linked to autism and sudden infant death syndrome, and why it's not even used under the age of 2 in Japan. Also, look at the actual manufacturer's ingredients, and look to see at the inert ingredients that are actually they're anything but inert. Formaldehyde is very active. Thimerosal, which is a mercury derivative with methylmercury going into the brain and immune system of baby, very active. Look at the medium which the vaccines were grown, especially with all the different passenger viruses that have gotten into the pool. For instance, they told us that we would not be at risk of any viruses, and then they gave us the SV40 virus, the simian virus 40. And look at the herpes 6. In fact, a lot of people got their herpes, not from sexually transmitted conditions, but because of vaccines. In fact, it's probable that more viruses that end up in our system that are harmful to our health because of vaccination than any other single condition. And then ask them this: what will happen if my child is exposed naturally to an antigen if they have and have not been vaccinated? They're two distinct schools of thought. Look at both schools of thought. Will the child be better off if they're fed right and nurtured right and then come into contact and actually get sick from something, because then they're immunized for life?
Right.
But if you immunize a child, taking a virus directly into the bloodstream, bacteria into the bloodstream, these antigens into the bloodstream, passing all the defense mechanisms, then when they are infected, they get a super strain that makes the condition worse. The literature is there. In the end, no one can tell you whether to or not to vaccinate. I certainly cannot be responsible for that. I can only provide you with the tools that are available to show you that there is reasonable questions that must be raised. And then ask yourself, what if you chose to get a homeopathic vaccine? The homeopathic one, at the very least, you're not putting any of the actual virus or actual bacteria or adjuvants into the baby's blood, but you're still giving it a homeopathic protection. So you should look at that option. Barbara Jo Fisher, the Vaccine Information Center, will have that information also. There are no less than 43 different vaccine information services that offer alternative opinions on the web. So you might want to go to the web and look under those. And if you actually look under my webpage, I give you many of their addresses and emails. So you can take it to the next level. And then find physicians who are on both sides of the position and ask them for their proof. It is not important what their opinion is. We have too many people with opinions that are not accurate. Look for the facts. Stay neutral till you get your facts. And then you'll see the strengths and weaknesses of other people who are trying to convince you to do something or not do something based upon their opinion. That's dangerous. So look for facts so you can make an intelligent, informed choice. They're there. Just take the time. Oh, there's the music. We're out of time. I want to thank you all very much for listening. I'm Gary Knoll. And I'll be out of town for the next 2.5 weeks. And I'll be back for a few days and then back out again, trying to do what we can to help give a different perspective on AIDS. Have a nice day.